Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to emmanmalley.com. Caravaggio. What does Caravaggio mean to you? I suppose in many ways, a lot of people on the island of Ireland had no knowledge of Caravaggio up until recent years. And then, purely by accident, it was discovered in Dublin, in one of the Jesuit houses there in Leeson Street, that each evening the Jesuits were sitting beneath a very famous painting as they dined. Turned out to be the taking of Christ by the 16th century, 17th century Italian artist Caravaggio. Now, my guest this afternoon is Walter Ellis, a local boy who's been travelling abroad for many years, living around the globe, now living in New York, married to an American lady who's a lecturer in graphics in one of the universities in New York. And he's just written a book inspired by the life and times of Caravaggio. But it's best, I suppose, left to Walter to fill in the background to this, because whilst it's a book which is inspired by Caravaggio, it's not the life and times of Caravaggio. It's a fictional novel as such. Walter, it's over to you.
Yes, I was trying to move into fiction, and like a lot of would-be novelists, I was casting around for subject matter. And I was sitting one day in New York and was reading a story, and I think it must have been the Irish Times, probably online, and it was recounting the story of how the taking of Christ, that great masterpiece, came to be found in the Jesuit house in Leeson Street. Now, in itself, that's one of the oddest art stories of last century. A very fetching tale, full of intrigue in itself. And then when you see the painting, or when I saw the painting, you realize that you are beholding, and one of the few to have done so for hundreds of years, one of the great masterpieces of the Baroque period, and by Caravaggio himself, the great master. And so it was astonishing on two levels. One, that it had ever been lost, and two, that it was ever found. And yet it was in itself such a fantastic painting.
So, okay, you read this article, you see the painting. So, how did it inspire you? What triggered this then?
Well, the story itself, of course, is full of intrigue. I mean, briefly, you have the artist painting this. It's the taking of Christ, which is a rendition of the scene in Gethsemane, where Judas comes up to Christ, kisses him on the cheek, and he's then arrested by the Romans. And the whole story then unfolds, which, of course, is the great story of Christianity. So that's the painting. But that was a recognized masterpiece in its day. Caravaggio had done it on commission, and it was a huge success. Everyone praised him for it, and he wasn't always praised for his paintings. But then, in the fullness of time, after his own tumultuous life came to an end, the painting itself, which remained in the hands of the same family that had commissioned it, just lay dormant. It lay on display in one of the palaces that the Roman noblemen tend to have, even to this day. And that lasted until the 18th century. And in the course of the 18th century, when the family were falling on hard times, along comes this Scottish adventurer doing the grand tour. And he sees the painting in the palace, offers the nobleman a sum of money for it in the belief that it's by a Dutch follower of Caravaggio. He makes off with the painting, keeps it in his castle in Scotland for a while. Then it gets sold again, a generation or two later, it gets sold again to an Irish member of an ex-army man who became an inspector in the RIC and was murdered in 1920 by the IRA. But the Jesuits were extremely kind, apparently, to his wife after the death of her husband, after he was murdered. And she was so grateful to them that she gave them this painting, which they then hung up in the Jesuit house in Leeson Street and forgot about for the next 60 years.
Well, of course, the very mention of the word murder tees us up to discuss the life of Caravaggio, a man of great notoriety, a man of great infamy, identified with murder himself. Now, where does this all fit into your novel?
Well, of course, mine is a fictionalized account of what happened, and it takes off, this takes the story into new directions concerning the epochal fight between Christianity and Islam in two time periods. Now, in Caravaggio's time, the Ottomans were once again on the rise. They had been defeated in a great naval battle at the Battle of Lepanto, and it was thought that was the end of the Islamic threat to Europe. But they came back in the early 17th century, and it was sometime after Caravaggio's death, quite a while after, that they reached the apogee of their fortunes and were hammering on the gates of Vienna. But during Caravaggio's time, there was a great coming and going, a great concern, a great fear about what was going to happen. And during this period, Caravaggio lived a wild and reckless life in Rome. There was a general concern in the air what the Ottomans were going to be doing, what they were up to, but he was much more concerned with getting on with his life. He was a sort of vagabond painter, a man of genius, of course, self-taught largely, but he was forever getting into fights. He was arrested, in fact, fled his native Milan for Rome because he was being pursued by the local Milanese police. Got to Rome, made his reputation, began to make a small fortune, kept losing it, gambling, fighting, quarreling, imprisonment. And eventually, sadly for him, he got into the fight of his life with a local mafiosi family. And I think that's genuinely the case. That's what they were. They ran a certain area, a quartier of Rome. He got into a fight with one of their members after a tennis match and got in a duel, killed the young man, and was therefore on the run, and the Catholic Church sentenced him to death as he fled south to Naples and on to Malta. So he was a man on the run for much of his life and spent the rest of his days similarly on the run, and eventually was died or was possibly murdered.
Just in case we've omitted to contextualise the epoch or the era, this is striding 16th, 17th
yes,
century.
Yes, we're moving into the early 17th century, and when the popes were extremely powerful, so were the great families and nobles, and there was a great deal of politicking in the air, both locally and nationally and internationally, because of the perceived Ottoman threat. And he was living this wild, strange, mercurial life, where in between being commissioned to paint and then painting some of the finest masterpieces of his time, he was fighting, whoring, and murdering.
Now, could you just explain to me, because when you're constructing a book, there are so many challenges for any author, any writer. Now, this book, as you pointed out at the beginning, at the outset, it straddles two eras, two
yes.
epochs. Bring us into that world, 16th, 17th century, and then in a very contemporary sense, because is it a case of you're seeing the parallels in history recurring with the Muslim world posing a threat to the West, etc., at this point in time?
Yes, it is. And I must emphasise that the fiction comes into this. I did a lot of research. I went to Rome. I did research into the life of Caravaggio and saw a lot of his paintings. But the fiction comes into it through the painting, which is genuine, of course, the taking of Christ. I maintain that the painting contains clues. It's not quite what it appears to be. And later, 400 years later, a little bit ahead of our own time, when Islam is once again on the march and there are fears throughout Europe of a possible Islamic takeover coming, we find that Caravaggio has left behind, in my fictional account, he has left behind clues through this great masterpiece as to what happened the first time around when there was a genuine threat to the Vatican and the Catholic hierarchy from Islamist enemies within. And that's the key between the two. In both instances, then and now, I'm positing the notion that there could be people inside the Vatican whose own plans are not necessarily of a Christian nature.
So are we in the world here of the Da Vinci Code? You seem to be leaving an awful lot of loose ends hanging out there.
Well, of course we're in that territory. I'm not pretending that this is a deeply literary work. I hope it's well written, and certainly I hope well researched. I think it's a good book and a good read. But yes, I'm extemporizing. I'm making it up. I'm saying this could have happened. In his time, there were these fears. These were very genuinely grounded fears. In our own time and a little bit ahead, it's quite possible that the fears that are now expressed across Europe of an Islamic takeover will come to have serious import. We will discover that Islam is on the rise. It's clearly the case. And there are fears for the future of the Catholic Church and indeed for the Vatican itself, which, according to Islamic prophecy, will be taken over by the Islamic faith, and Rome will become the capital of the Islamic world.
Walter, let me ask you something. Did Caravaggio have any redeeming features for you? Did you get to like him?
Oh, yes, I did like. I did get to like him very much. I mean, I think if I'd known him, if I were hanging about with him in Rome in those days, I'd have found him very difficult. He was a tough nut.
Was he the Paddy Kavanagh of Italy?
Well, yeah, I believe he was foul-mouthed. He was quick-tempered. He took offence very easily, which is one of the main reasons he was constantly in trouble with the constables.
For our listeners, just in case they're not familiar with Patrick Kavanagh was the celebrated Enniskine poet who was around Dublin in the 60s and 70s. And despite the greatness of his poetry, he was deemed to be very truculent and difficult. So I just want to contextualise that when we're speaking the Caravaggio, because he was even accused of murder, all like Patrick Kavanagh. But Patrick was accused of many other things in his time.
Yeah. Well, as indeed was Caravaggio. His sexuality has never been clearly established. There are biographers who maintain that he was gay, and some of his paintings would reflect that and certainly suggest it. Others have said, no, there's no proper evidence for this. He was a properly carousing gentleman who spent a lot of his time with the whores of Rome, and indeed frequently used them for his models. In some of his more famous paintings, he scandalized the church when it was discovered that the models, for example, for the Dormition of the Virgin, that the model used was in fact a prostitute. Similarly, when he painted a painting of Mary Magdalene, though perhaps in a sense more appropriately, again, it was a young prostitute he used as a model. The church was scandalized and highly offended, but they kept coming back to him because he was just so good.
So how did you resolve all these problems, these difficulties in the denouement of your book?
Well, I think I create a character for whom we feel great sympathy towards the end, because the end of his life, I mean, in real life, was tragic and rather terrible. He was seeking redemption. He had gone to Malta, where he actually ended up a knight of Malta, but once again got into trouble. He struck one of the other knights with the flat of his sword and was imprisoned in the deepest dungeon in Europe, but miraculously escaped. And he escaped back via Sicily and Naples to Rome in order to gain a pardon from the Pope, the new Pope. But before he could get there, he landed in Porto Ercole in 1610 and in the mosquito-infected swamp, and died apparently of cholera, but possibly poisoned, possibly murdered. His body was lost for many, many years.
Isn't it extraordinary? He was seeking some form of redemption, obviously. There are many characters, many personalities in art and literature who didn't seek redemption. Local artist Paddy McCann was telling me recently that he had followed in the footsteps of one of the great American painters, mm-hmm. who was obsessed and possessed by so many demons. But he was terrified that he was going to actually lose his demons or get rid of his demons, because he felt his edginess, that which he brought to his art,
yes,
would be diminished if he should lose that edge. But here, your character, Caravaggio, and the protagonist of your book, seeks redemption. And was there ever reconciliation inside the head, do you think?
Possibly inside his head, but he by then had made so many enemies, latterly within the order of the Knights of Malta. And then when he went to Naples, he was attacked savagely one night in a tavern and had a portion of his skull lopped off with a sword, so that he was gravely disfigured for his last journey. So I think when he made that last wretched boat journey back to Rome, he was an immensely sad and broken man whose only hope was that he could meet the Pope and persuade the Holy Father that in fact he was a man with a soul who was worthy of salvation. So he was going to prostrate himself at the feet of the Pope, but never got to do so, because tragically he either died or was murdered on the way.
It is quite remarkable listening to you, Walter, because I almost feel as if I'm back sitting in one of the lecture rooms in Trinity College, listening to Professor Nigel Lindinning talking about Cervantes or Lope de Vega or somebody of that generation, you know. Mm-hmm. The bowels of history, we're back down into the bowels of history. And yet fast forward, and we're into a very contemporary society where you speak of this Islamist threat to the West. So what do we deduce from your work then, in terms of what is the lesson?
The lesson of history is that we don't learn it. But I'm unable to say how things will develop, and certainly it's possible to exaggerate or appear to exaggerate the threat to our own society, our own civilization from the Islamic world. And I don't wish to overplay that. For example, in the book, I don't make any of the protagonists of Islam to be other than Europeans converted to the cause. I'm not suggesting at any point that there is some kind of grim racial takeover by Muslims from outside. But yes, in every era, there's always a great threat, either an actual great threat or a great perceived threat. And I think in our own time, if we leave out the recession just for the moment, which is difficult to do, the other great perceived threat is from, certainly in places like England, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland even, the great perceived threat is that of emigration, migration, and Islam. And that is exactly the same fear that was felt 400 years ago and 500 years ago, and prior to that, 1,000, 1,200 years ago in Europe, as each time Islam rose again in a desperate bid to actually recreate the caliphate, which they say will dominate the world.
Something which has just been occurring to me there as you speak, I mentioned the painter who was decadent in disposition in America, Philip Guston, mm-hmm. And he wanted to remain like that. Does Caravaggio, does the protagonist of your work, in many ways represent the human condition, frailties, weaknesses, struggle, spleen, ideal? Is it all there?
Well, it certainly is embodied in him. It could fairly be said that several of the other characters in the book, including cardinals, and I hasten to add that one of the heroic protagonists of the book is the first ever, in my view, Irish leader of the Jesuits. The first Father General of the Jesuits is an Irishman called O'Malley, who is actually the hero of the book and prevents the awful events from taking place that we fear throughout the book will take place. But yes, he and all of the main characters in the book do reflect that they live in times of tumult. And I think we ourselves, obviously, here in Ireland, we're not so concerned for obvious reasons with an Islamic takeover, but we are seeing society break down. We are seeing great events emerging elsewhere in America, in Europe, moving towards us, affecting our lives, reducing our ability to make our own decisions. And this is happening to governments, it's happening to individuals, it's happening to companies, corporations, and I can't imagine that it isn't also happening to artists. I'd be very surprised if artists functioning today didn't do so in the context of a deepening recession and fear of civilizational collapse.
Well, it's been fascinating listening to you, and just to bring Caravaggio closer to home, even closer than Dublin, I'm here in my studio interviewing you, Walter, with a portrait of the Northern Ireland Assembly painted by the local artist Noel Murphy, who has just recently held an exhibition in Belfast, which was very much inspired by Caravaggio, because that particular period of his life through which he's been living has been very much on the edge. And in many ways, I think he believes that he was Caravaggio back on the run. From authority, everything, given the economic austerity, etc., here in Northern Ireland. So, delightful to have you here this afternoon, Walter. Good luck with your new publication. And cost, price?
I think the price in sterling is £9.99. It's called, of course, The Caravaggio Conspiracy, and it's published by the Lilliput Press of Dublin. It was also published last year in Italy, but I don't think you need concern yourselves with that.
And in Italian it was called?
It was in Italian Il Codice Caravaggio. So I'm obliged either to be a conspirator or a Da Vinci Code man. I'm not sure which I prefer.
Good afternoon, Walter Ellis. Thank you very much indeed for being our guest this afternoon from emmanmalley.com. Good afternoon.